As much as anything, it was a city of entertainments. And this, to Abigail, was its saving grace. She joked about seeing a learned pig dancing dogs and a little hare that beats a drum. Amusements fit for children. But she openly enjoyed them, and with Nabby went more than once to Sadler's Wells Music Hall to delight in the wonderful feats of a troupe of tumblers. The three Adamses went often to the theater and to Ranelagh Gardens in Chelsea, where, in company with fashionable London society, they strolled garden paths, sipped imperial tea, listened to music, or gazed at paintings within an immense gilded rotunda. Smollett had described Ranelagh as looking like the enchanted palace of a genie, crowded with the great, the rich, the gay, the happy, and the fair. To Abigail, the fair on display were more stunning by far than any to be seen at court. Pleased to be in a Protestant country once more, the family attended church regularly. Riding to the village of Hackney to hear the celebrated liberal preacher and champion of America, Richard Price, who was to become a valued friend. Once, for no reason other than intellectual curiosity, Adams rode to Windsor to call on the famous English astronomer Sir William Herschel, whose crowning achievement had been the discovery of the planet Uranus. Greeting Adams affably, Herschel was delighted to talk of his work, and Adams returned to Grosvenor Square elated. Nabby recorded that she had never known her father so gratified by a visit of any kind. But neither the Reverend Price's friendship nor William Herschel's reception was representative. With the exception of tradesmen and a few officials of the government, the British overall were decidedly cool toward the new American minister and his family. Perfunctory, but no more. And they did stare as Adams had worried they would, and not in a friendly way. "The English may call the French starers," wrote Nabby to John Quincy, "but I never saw so little civility and politeness in a stare in France as I have here." To Jefferson, with whom she had commenced regular correspondence, Abigail described the atmosphere as not the pleasantest in the world. In truth, the American minister and his family were being pointedly ignored. Their society was confined almost entirely to other Americans living in London, or to such openly avowed friends of America as Richard Price. A few of the Americans were acquaintances from Boston, like the aspiring young architect Charles Bulfinch. Jefferson's aide, William Short, came on errands from Paris, and the duplicitous Dr. Edward Bancroft showed up, affable as always. Whether Bancroft was serving still as a spy for the British government is not known, though in all likelihood he was. Friendliest and most helpful were the American painters Benjamin West and John Singleton Copley, who introduced the family to their protégés, young Mather Brown of Boston and John Trumbull of Connecticut, a veteran of the Revolution. A rage for painters and painting had seized the household, Nabby reported excitedly to John Quincy, after Mather Brown set up his easel at Grosvenor Square to do portraits of all three of the Adamses. Her delight was extreme. The young man was so striking-looking as to be commonly spoken of as Handsome Young Brown, as though that were his name. Brown's portrait of her was quite tasty, she thought. Wearing a wide-brimmed hat with ribbons and feather, she sat with her hands in her lap, looking directly ahead, a lovely, poised, somewhat wistful young woman at the threshold of adulthood. Her father was charmed. "It was her exactly," he said. For his own portrait, Adams posed at his writing desk, with quill and paper in hand, and Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia prominently displayed to one side. Adams believed his strongest attributes were, as he said, candor, probity, and decision. But these he failed to find in the face that looked back from the finished canvas, and he expressed disappointment. In Brown's portrait, he appeared composed, leaner than Copley had portrayed him, and reflective. It was a fine study of an 18th-century gentleman of consequence, but nothing about the pose or the expression gave any suggestion of his characteristic alertness and vitality, or sense of humor, let alone candor, probity, and decision. Brown's rendering of Abigail was thought a good likeness, but the painting would ultimately disappear. Meantime, West and Copley, in particular, opened doors for Adams in London, as did no one else. "I did not ask favors or receive anything but cold formalities from ministers of state or ambassadors," he would explain. "I found that our American painters had more influence at court to produce all the favors I wanted." Economies remained a constant concern. The cost of living in London was higher even than in Paris. And to make matters worse, Congress had cut Adams's salary by a fifth, from £2,500 to £2,000. A dinner guest from Scotland would describe a meal with the Adamses as good but plain, while Jefferson, visiting later, would be astonished by how very plain they lived. Writing to Mercy Warren after the first year in London, Adams would confide, "I am driven to my wit's end for means." Lavish entertainment of the kind expected of an ambassador to the court was out of the question. But then, neither did the Adamses have any great desire for London society. She was too old-fashioned, Abigail said, for keeping company with midnight gamblers and titled gamesters, whose way of life she had seen something of and may have enjoyed more than she was willing to admit. At a party given by the Swedish ambassador, pressed to fill an empty place at one of the card tables, she won four games straight. Worst of all was being patronized by the British. One of the few British women to call on Abigail since the move to Grosvenor Square, the wife of a member of Parliament remarked, in an effort to make conversation, "But surely you prefer this country to America." British prejudice toward the French struck Abigail as ludicrous, now that she had lived in France, and made her realize how greatly she disliked prejudice in any form. But then, unexpectedly, she was brought up short to find it in herself. Having read and loved the plays of Shakespeare since childhood, she was thrilled by the chance to see an actual stage production. The great English tragedian, Sarah Siddons, who had come out of retirement the year before, appeared in Macbeth for the first time and was acclaimed a triumph. That Mrs. Siddons then appeared in Othello, making the transition from Lady Macbeth to Desdemona, was declared the mark of genius, and the Adamses were among the glittering audiences that filled the Drury Lane for both productions. To Abigail, Mrs. Siddons was brilliant but miscast as Lady Macbeth. It was in Othello as Desdemona that she was interesting beyond any actress I had ever seen. Yet to read of Desdemona in the arms of a black man was, Abigail found, not the same as seeing it before her eyes. Othello, played by John Kemble, was represented blacker than any African, she wrote. Whether it was from the prejudices of education or from a natural antipathy, she knew not. But my whole soul shuddered whenever I saw the sooty heretic Moor touch the fair Desdemona. Othello was manly, generous, noble in character, so much that was admirable. Still, she could not separate the color from the man. Filled with self-reproach, she affirmed that there was something estimable in everyone. And the liberal mind regards not what nation or climate it springs up in, nor what color or complexion the man is of. Attacks on Adams in the press continued. He was called a nobody, ridiculed for having insufficient means to conduct himself in proper fashion. The Public Advertiser reminded its readers that all so-called American patriots were cowards, murderers, and traitors, and described Adams as looking pretty fat and flourishing, considering the low estate he is reduced to. In letters to the editor, he was decried as a Pharisee of liberty, an impostor. "Every hireling scribbler was set to vilify them," wrote Abigail, who in her time in London acquired a dislike of the press that would last a lifetime. From Paris, where he was well supplied with London papers, Jefferson expressed astonishment at such slanders, as well as admiration for Adams's fortitude. "Indeed, a man must be of rock who can stand all this," he wrote to Abigail. "To Mr. Adams it will be but one victory the more." Then, in a rare revelation of inner feeling, a confession of weakness such as he seldom made to anyone, Jefferson told her, "It would have ill-suited me. I do not love difficulties. I am fond of quiet, willing to do my duty, but made irritable by slander and apt to be forced by it to abandon my post. These are weaknesses from which reason and your counsels will preserve Mr. Adams." Possibly, he postulated, it was the quantity of animal food eaten by the English which renders their character unsusceptible of civilization. He had been taken up by the Paris literati, he reported happily, and acquired a larger, more expensive house for himself. Located at the corner of the Champs-Élysées and the Rue de Berry, the newly built Hôtel de Langeac had 24 rooms, an indoor toilet, and a clever garden. Not satisfied with it as it was, Jefferson proceeded to redesign and reconstruct much of the house to suit his fancy, thus adding further to the expense, and despite grave concern over his own private finances. To his brother-in-law, Francis Epps, who was managing his affairs at home, Jefferson wrote, "The torment of mind I endure till the moment shall arrive when I shall owe not a shilling on earth is such really as to render life of little value." But what could he do? He could not sell any more of his land, he wrote. He had sold too much as it was, and land was his only provision for his children. "Nor," he added, "would I willingly sell the slaves as long as there remains any prospect of paying my debts with their labors." Had Jefferson been as forthcoming with Adams as with his brother-in-law, Adams, the farmer's son, would have had no argument with Jefferson's faith in land as the only true wealth. But that Jefferson could so matter-of-factly consider selling off his slaves, not freeing them, and so readily transfer the burdens of his own extravagances to the backs of those he held in bondage, would have struck Adams as unconscionable, and would no doubt have been a serious test of his respect, if not affection, for the man. But such matters as these Jefferson never mentioned or discussed with Adams. Meanwhile, he and Abigail exchanged shopping requests. Jefferson purchased French shoes and lace for her, and hunted down French dessert platters of a kind she had her heart set on for her dining table. For her part, Abigail was to pick out a dozen English shirts for him, a tablecloth, and napkins sufficient for a seating of 20. "But when writing to you," he declared at the close of one letter, "I fancy myself at Otaï, and chatter on till the last page of my paper awakes me from my reverie." Occasions at court grew increasingly tedious and strained for Adams and his family.
"Do you go out much for a walk?" the king kept inquiring of Abigail and Nabby at each and every reception, though the king, they thought, at least dissembled better than the queen, whose countenance, said Nabby, was as hard and unfeeling as if carved out of an oak knot. Particularly grating to Adams was the oft-spoken assumption among many of the British that sooner or later America would, of course, return to the British fold. "There is a strong propensity in this people," he wrote to Richard Henry Lee, "to believe that America is weary of her independence, that she wishes to come back, that the states are in confusion, Congress has lost its authority, The governments of the states have no influence, no laws, no order, poverty, distress, ruin, and wretchedness. That no navigation acts we can make will be obeyed, no duties we lay on can be collected. That smuggling will defeat all our prohibitions, imposts, and revenues. This they love to believe. There was indeed a new order of things arisen in the world, Adams emphasized to another correspondent at home. But British statesmen refused to comprehend this. Overall, the attitude toward America, he had come to realize, was hardly less hostile than it had been during the war. "They hate us," he wrote to a friend. One Englishman had declared in his presence, "I had rather America had been annihilated than that she should have carried her point." Much of this he and Abigail attributed to venom spread by American loyalists in London. One vehement figure, Harrison Gray, once the treasurer of Massachusetts, said in a letter to the press that if it were left to him, he would have John Adams hanged. Adams remained remarkably calm, nonetheless, conducting himself with model composure and refusing to have any contact with loyalists, with one exception. Taking the initiative, he hunted up his old friend Jonathan Sewell, whom he had not seen since the day they bid farewell at Casco Bay in what seemed a lifetime before. Adams rode to Sewell's London lodgings, and, as Sewell wrote afterward, it was a memorable reunion. "When Mr. Adams came in, he took my hand in both his, and with a hearty squeeze accosted me in these words, 'How do you do, my dear old friend?' Our conversation was just such as might be expected at the meeting of two old, sincere friends after a long separation." They talked for 2 hours. Neither had changed his views on the Revolution, nor his enmity for the side the other had chosen, though apparently nothing of this was said. Through the years of the war, Sewell had taken heart from every American defeat, every report of dissension in the American army, and from the news of Benedict Arnold's return to his proper allegiances. Like many loyalists living in exile in England, Sewell had had a difficult time getting by. Exiled from their homeland, unappreciated in their adopted country, most loyalists had a hard life. Sewell had grown bitter and resentful. His hatred of New England patriots was worse than ever. "Those sanctified hypocrites," he called them, "those rebellious, ungenerous, ungrateful sons of bitches." Suffering bouts of melancholia, he had largely withdrawn from life, seldom leaving his rooms. Noticeably aged, he lived only for his two sons, he confessed to Adams, and for their sakes, planned to remove to Canada. Adams urged Sewell and his wife, Esther Quincy, to come and take a family dinner at Grosvenor Square, and in a way so friendly and hearty, wrote Sewell, that he almost complied, but could not, would not. "Adams has a heart formed for friendship, and susceptible to its finest feelings," Sewell continued in his account of the reunion. "He is humane, generous, and open, warm in his friendly attachments, though perhaps rather implacable to those he thinks his enemies." Clearly, Adams did not regard Sewell as his enemy. Each felt he knew the other as well as he knew any man. And privately, Adams thought Sewell, in 1774, had tragically sacrificed principle for position, while Sewell, as he wrote, thought Adams's own unbounded ambition was at fault. This, and an enthusiastic zeal for the imagined or real glory and welfare of his country, had overcome Adams's better self, his every good and virtuous social and friendly principle. With some understandable resentment, perhaps, Sewell concluded that Adams had gone as far as his ambition would take him, and further, that he was ill-suited for his present role. He is not qualified by nature or education to shine in courts. His abilities are undoubtedly equal to the mechanical parts of his business as ambassador, but this is not enough. He cannot dance, drink, game, flatter, promise, dress, swear with the gentlemen, and small talk and flirt with the ladies. In short, he has none of the essential arts or ornaments which constitute a courtier. There are thousands who, with a tenth of his understanding, and without a spark of his honesty, would distance him infinitely in any court in Europe. For all the warmth of the reunion, the expressions of brotherhood, the 2 hours were difficult. Adams came away deeply saddened. He would forever think of Sewall as one of the casualties of the war. According to Adams, when Sewall died in New Brunswick a number of years later, it was of a broken heart. Section 2. Of the multiple issues in contention between Britain and the new United States of America, and that John Adams had to address as minister, nearly all were holdovers from the Treaty of Paris, agreements made but not resolved concerning debts, the treatment of loyalists, compensation for slaves and property confiscated by the British, and the continued presence of British troops in America. All seemed insoluble. With its paper money nearly worthless, its economy in shambles, the United States was desperate for trade. Yet, without the power or prestige to make demands or even, it seemed, to qualify for respect. British complacency was massive. The British saw no cause for haste in fulfilling any of the agreements with their poor, weak former adversary. Nor were they the least inclined to lessen or jeopardize in any way their primacy at sea. British reluctance to be accommodating was quite as great as the American need for equitable resolutions. The British continued to exclude American vessels from both Canada and the West Indies, as well as from Britain. Further, no American products could be shipped anywhere within the British Empire except in British vessels. To Adams, the first priority must be to open British ports to American ships. But his efforts came to nothing. While at home, under the Articles of Confederation enacted in 1781, Congress was without power to regulate commerce. It was thus a sad and humiliating situation. Adams went repeatedly to Whitehall to meet with Lord Carmarthen. He called at 10 Downing Street for an exchange with the Prime Minister, William Pitt the Younger, who was all of 24 years old, who never stopped talking and impressed Adams not at all. Whatever Adams proposed, whatever inquiries he made to the ministry, he received no answers. Long days and nights were spent reporting to Foreign Secretary Jay and composing memorials to Carmarthen. One particularly important memorial, calling for the withdrawal of British garrisons from the Northwest, as agreed in the Treaty of Paris, went unanswered for 3 months. When at last Carmarthen replied, it was to say only that this violation of the treaty was no different from the failure of Americans to pay the debts due British creditors. Adams was hardly surprised. From his first meeting with Pitt, he had been convinced that Britain would never willingly give up the forts, any more than they would open the way to American trade with the West Indies. When Adams talked of commercial reciprocity, the British thought him naive. Like Jefferson, Adams believed in free trade in theory, but faced with British intransigence, he began losing hope of ever attaining such an agreement and cautioned Jefferson, "We must not, my friend, be the bubbles of our own liberal sentiments." Presently, the picture no brighter, he told Jefferson that if the British court refused to act a reasonable and equitable part, the United States should enter into still closer and stronger connections with France. Commercial relations with France, however, were no more promising than with Britain. Jefferson, who was as dedicated to close ties with the French as ever Franklin had been, had thus far succeeded in attaining a single agreement, one whereby American whale oil would be admitted to French markets, and this for a limited time only. Since the end of the war, the French, for their part, had attained nothing like the flourishing American trade that Vergennes had imagined. The demand for French goods in America was low and not likely to improve. When, in a meeting with Lord Carmarthen, Adams summoned all his old intensity to warn that the attitude of the British, if continued, would inevitably strengthen commercial ties between the United States and France, it had no effect whatever. He saw no hope, Adams reported to Jefferson. Correspondence between Grosvenor Square and Paris remained steady and candid. In 8 months' time, from late May 1785, when Adams first assumed his post in London, until February 1786, he wrote 28 letters to Jefferson, and Jefferson wrote a nearly equal number in return. Entirely trusting of one another, the two ministers exchanged news, opinions on issues, speculations on potential markets for American tobacco in Europe. One long letter from Adams was devoted to Portugal's need for American timber, tar, turpentine, and salt fish, as well as the corresponding future market in America for Portuguese wine and olive oil. When Jefferson asked Adams to inquire about ensuring the life of the sculptor Udon, who was sailing for America to do the Statue of Washington, discussion of the matter went back and forth in several letters before Adams had things arranged. A small but noteworthy difference in the letters was that Jefferson regularly signed himself in conventional fashion, "Your obedient and humble servant," or "Your friend and servant," while Adams wrote, "Yours most affectionately," or "With great and sincere esteem," or "My dear friend, adieu." Increasingly, their time and correspondence was taken up by concerns over American shipping in the Mediterranean and demands for tribute made by the Barbary states of North Africa, Algiers, Tripoli, Tunis, and Morocco. To ensure their Mediterranean trade against attacks by the Barbary pirates, the nations of Europe customarily made huge cash payments. It was extortion and an accepted part of the cost of commerce in that part of the world. France paid $200,000 a year to Algiers alone. Britain paid even more, as much as $280,000 annually. In past years, before the war, when American trade in the Mediterranean flourished, American ships had come under the protection paid for by the British. But after 1776, such protection no longer pertained. Nor would France now foot the cost of guaranteeing respect for the American flag off the shores of North Africa. Tribute, bribes, would have to be paid, and it would cost the United States dearly, Vergennes had advised Adams earlier. Otherwise, there would be no peace with the Barbary states. Just weeks after Adams arrived in London, in July 1785, two American ships were seized by Algerian pirates. 21 American sailors were taken captive and forced into slave labor. News spread that Benjamin Franklin, en route from France to Philadelphia, had been captured by Barbary pirates, and though untrue, the story caused a sensation. From Philadelphia, John Jay sent instructions to negotiate with the Barbary states. Funds were made available by Congress, up to $80,000. But Adams and Jefferson had no money at hand. When Jefferson inquired whether Adams might borrow again from the Dutch, and reported that French officers in Paris were angry over not having been paid what they were due for services in the Revolution, Adams was helpless to do anything. It was not at all certain, he answered, that there would be funds sufficient even to cover your subsistence and mine. On a chill evening in February came what Adams took to be an opening. At the end of a round of ambassadorial visits, he stopped to pay his respects to a new member of the diplomatic corps in London, His Excellency Abdurrahman, envoy of the Sultan of Tripoli. It was apparently a spur-of-the-moment decision on Adams's part, and resulted in an amazing, smoke-filled exchange that Adams, delighted by the humor of the scene, happily recounted for Jefferson. Adams and his host settled into two large chairs before a great fire, while a pair of factotums stood by at attention. As His Excellency Abdurrahman spoke no English, they got by on scraps of Italian and French. His Excellency wished to know about American tobacco. That grown in Tripoli was far too strong, the American much better, he said, as two immensely long pipes were brought in, ceremoniously filled, and lighted. "It is long since I took a pipe, but," Adams wrote, "with great complacency I placed the bowl upon the carpet and smoked in awful pomp, reciprocating whiff for whiff until coffee was brought in. His Excellency took a cup after I had taken one, and alternately sipped at his coffee and whiffed at his tobacco, and I followed the example with such exactness and solemnity that one of the two secretaries cried out in ecstasy, 'Monsieur, vous êtes un Turc!'" The conversation turned to business. America was a great nation, declared His Excellency, but unfortunately a state of war existed between America and Tripoli. Adams questioned how that could be, given there had been no injury, insult, or provocation on either side. The Barbary states were the sovereigns of the Mediterranean all the same, he was told, and without a treaty of peace, there could be no peace between Tripoli and America. His Excellency was prepared to arrange such a treaty. 2 days later, at the stroke of noon, His Excellency appeared at Grosvenor Square, flanked by servants in orange robes and turbans. Time was critical, Adams was informed. The sooner peace was made between America and the Barbary States, the better. Were a treaty delayed, it would be more difficult to make. A war between Christian and Christian was mild. Prisoners were treated with humanity. But, warned His Excellency, a war between Muslim and Christian could be horrible. The man was either a consummate politician or truly benevolent and wise. Adams could not tell which. And though apprehensive that the sums demanded would be exorbitant, he felt there was no time to lose. He dispatched Colonel Smith to Paris with a letter urging Jefferson to come as quickly as possible. His visit, Adams suggested, could be attributed to his desire to see England and pay his respects at court. Jefferson arrived on March 11, 1786, to find London brightened by a light dusting of snow. He settled into rooms on Golden Square for a stay, as it turned out, of nearly 2 months, during which the ties of friendship with John and Abigail became stronger than ever. Since they had last seen him, Jefferson had become noticeably more elegant in attire. He had taken to powdering his hair and acquired a French valet de chambre, Adrien Petit, who had earlier worked for the Adamses. He looked every inch the polished courtier, and with his height and slim good looks drew attention everywhere they went. At a meeting with Ambassador Abdurrahman, Adams and Jefferson were told that peace with Tripoli would cost 30,000 guineas for his employers, as His Excellency put it, plus 3,000 pounds sterling for himself. Payments were to be in cash on delivery of the treaty signed by his sovereign. The two Americans protested that the figure was too high. His Excellency assured them it was his lowest price, and allowed that peace with all Barbary states might cost from 200 to 300,000 guineas. They could only refer the matter to Congress, Adams and Jefferson replied, and the meeting ended. Compared to such demands, the sum Congress had authorized them to spend was, as they reported to John Jay, but a drop in the bucket. Several meetings with Lord Carmarthen were no more encouraging with Jefferson present than they had been for Adams for months past. Jefferson felt insulted by Carmarthen's seeming aversion to have anything to do with us. When Adams presented Jefferson at the King's levee at St. James's on March 15th, George III could not have been more ungracious in his notice of Mr. Adams and myself, according to an account later provided by Jefferson. Later still, a grandson of Adams's would take this to mean the king had turned his back on them, and the story would become rooted in history. But almost certainly no such incident occurred. Jefferson said nothing to the effect at the time, nor did any of the numerous ministers, courtiers, members of Parliament, or other diplomats present, who were ever watchful for the slightest sign of royal disapproval or anything the least out of the ordinary. Nothing untoward was reported or hinted at in the newspapers, and, importantly, nothing was ever said or written by John Adams, who, of all men, would have been enraged by any disrespect shown a minister of the United States being presented under his sponsorship. Whatever the truth of the situation, Jefferson's sensitivity to British hauteur was real, his dislike of the British sufficient to last a lifetime. "They require to be kicked into common good manners," he told Colonel Smith. The fact that his debts were largely to English creditors may well have had something to do with such feelings. Of London, he thought only the shops worthy of attention, and devoted ample time to them, spending lavishly on shoes, boots, a flintlock rifle, a reading lamp, plaited harness and stirrups, and a set of chessmen. His major, most costly purchases were British-made scientific instruments, which he conceded were the finest available. Possibly at the urging of Abigail, he also paid a shilling to see the learned pig. As at Otaï, Jefferson was a frequent presence at the house on Grosvenor Square, delighting all with his sparkling conversation and fund of information. Abigail gave several dinners in his honor. John arranged a tour of the King's Library. There were repeated evenings at the theater. Jefferson would see three performances by Mrs. Siddons in three different roles, and a late night at the French ambassador's ball in the splendorous Hôtel de France on Hyde Park, an occasion marked by the presence of many very brilliant ladies of the first distinction, as Abigail noted. Appraising the figure she herself cut at such gatherings, Abigail was good-naturedly realistic. She had grown as large as her two sisters combined, she claimed to Mary Cranch, and John was keeping pace with her. "Pity the poor horse that would ever have to carry both of them," she wrote. Recording in his diary the names of the few specimens of the British aristocracy who ventured conversation with him at the French ambassador's ball, Adams noted, "This people cannot look me in the face. There is a conscious guilt and shame in their countenances when they look at me. They feel they have behaved ill, and that I am sensible of it." When, after weeks of waiting, there was still no more word from Lord Carmarthen, and the ambassador from Portugal, the one European minister to have shown any interest in opening trade negotiations, was reported too ill to see them, Adams and Jefferson decided to take a break from London and go off on a tour of English gardens, what Abigail called their little journey into the country. She and John had not been apart since they were reunited in London, the summer of 1784, not for a year and 8 months, which she noted was the longest time they had had together since they were married. Time away in Jefferson's company would, she was sure, do John great good. They set off on April 4th, traveling by hired coach, sharing expenses, and accompanied by their two servants, John Breisler and Adrien Petit. They moved rapidly and covered a great deal of ground in just 6 days, relying on Jefferson's copy of Observations on Modern Gardening by Thomas Whately as their guide, the last word on English gardens. Their direction was west along the Thames, where the English countryside was in its April glory. Mornings were often cool, but with hazy sunshine breaking through by midday. Willow trees were in leaf, there were cherry blossoms, and an abundance of daffodils in bloom. And the more miles that passed, the more the landscape opened up, with broad green hillsides covered with sheep and scampering newborn lambs by the hundreds. In the long, eventful lives of Adams and Jefferson, it was an excursion of no importance to history. But it was the one and only time they ever spent off on their own together, free of work and responsibility, and at heart both were countrymen, farmers, with an avid interest in soils, tillage, climate, and improvements. "There is not a sprig of grass that grows uninteresting to me," Jefferson was fond of saying, and Adams, in the spirit of 18th-century hyperbole, might well have agreed. Each kept occasional notes on the journey, and while Jefferson showed more interest in practical things, where Adams was inclined to remark on the historical or literary associations of the places they saw, this does not necessarily preclude a comparable interest in most everything encountered. Adams was quite as interested in proper land management as Jefferson. Jefferson possibly cared as much for Shakespeare as did Adams. The first stops were two that Jefferson had already made a few days earlier on his own, but was happy to repeat. Both, Alexander Pope's garden beside the Thames at Twickenham and Woburn Farm, were prime examples of the modern or new style English landscape gardening that was so radically different from the highly symmetrical gardens made fashionable by the French, and particularly by the work of André La Nôtre at Versailles in the time of Louis XIV. In the new style, there was no regularity. Instead, a seemingly natural arrangement of open grasslands, winding paths, clumps and groves of trees, in combination with an abundant presence of water in the form of serpentine lakes, streams, and artificial cataracts, was intended to evoke the look of an idealized English landscape. It was all to appear to be the work of the hand of God, but was in fact the doing of the master hand of the landscape gardener or architect. Everything was chosen for effect. The disposition of trees was of particular importance, and among the trees and lakes were nearly always arranged a variety of classic temples or pavilions, a faux ruin or grotto, all very romantic in spirit, their size and number depending on the wealth or fancy of the client. Such gardens could extend over hundreds of acres. They were not flower gardens, but private parks. Architects, gardeners, and clients thought of themselves as working like landscape painters, only on a vast scale and with scores of laborers at their bidding. Whole valleys were carved out, hilltops removed, streams rerouted, thousands of trees planted to achieve the desired look. The colossal expense seemed of no concern. Gardening, in the perfection to which it has been lately brought in England, is entitled to a place of considerable rank among the liberal arts, declared the ultimate authority, Thomas Whately. While Adams noted Woburn's beauty, Jefferson concentrated on the distribution of labor. 4 people to the farm, 4 to the pleasure garden, 4 to the kitchen garden, he recorded. Another day, April 6th, they toured the ultimate expression of the new style. Stowe, a true 18th-century marvel, was the largest, grandest, most famous landscape garden in England. It had been praised in poetry by Pope, acclaimed by Rousseau, and was the work in part of the most famous English landscape gardener of the day, Lancelot Brown. Capability Brown, as he was known for his habit of extolling to clients the capabilities of their property. But it was also the design of architect William Kent, and of its late owner and guiding spirit, Richard Grenville Temple, Lord Cobham. Set in a rolling sweep of land that lent a feeling of even grander scale, the estate comprised approximately 400 acres and was approached through a tremendous Corinthian arch. In addition to a columned manor house commanding one ridge, there were all the requisite lakes and waterfalls, bridges, and architectural niceties. A Temple of Victory, Temple of Venus, Temple of Bacchus, a faux Gothic temple. Everything romantic in spirit. For a panoramic view, said to take in five counties, Adams climbed a circular stairway to the top of a 115-foot observation tower built in his lordship's memory. "I mounted with pleasure," Adams wrote, "as Lord Cobham's name was familiar to me from Pope's works." Whether Jefferson made the climb is not clear, as he recorded nothing of it. But then, neither did he say a word in his notes about a beautiful bridge done in the manner of his adored Palladio, or the Temple of Victory, the honey-colored showpiece of the garden, which was very like the Maison Carrée, the Roman temple at Nîmes, which Jefferson was later to see on his travels in southern France and take as the model for his design for the capital of Virginia. What he did record was that 33 men and boys were required to tend the grounds, and that he considered the huge Corinthian arch useless, inasmuch as it had no pretension to direction. Adams found the total effect greatly to his liking, but thought temples to Venus and Bacchus unnecessary, as mankind had no need of artificial incitements to such amusements. If Stowe was the ultimate in fashionable private splendor, the Shakespeare House in Stratford-on-Avon, the next stop, was as humble as could be imagined. Told that an old wooden chair in a corner by the chimney was where the bard himself had sat, the two American tourists cut off souvenir chips, this according to the custom, as Adams was quick to note. But he was distressed by how little evidence remained of Shakespeare, either of the man or the miracle of his mind. There is nothing preserved of this great genius, which might inform us what education, what company, what accident turned his mind to letters and drama, Adams lamented. Jefferson noted only that he paid a shilling to see the house and Shakespeare's grave. But years afterward, Adams would claim that Jefferson, on arriving at Stratford-on-Avon, had actually gotten down on his knees and kissed the ground. At Edgehill, scene of the first great battle of the English Civil War, and later at Worcester, the setting of Cromwell's final victory over Charles II in the year 1651, it was Adams's turn to be deeply moved. This was history he knew in detail. "Here were scenes where free men had fought for their rights," he wrote in his diary. Finding some of the local residents sadly ignorant of the subject, he gave them an impromptu lecture. "And do Englishmen so soon forget the ground where liberty was fought for?" he asked. "Tell your neighbors and your children that this is holy ground. All England should come in pilgrimage to this hill once a year." To Adams, it appeared his exhortation had animated and pleased his audience. What the expression may have been on Jefferson's face, there is no telling. Nor, regrettably, did either man write of what passed between them along the way, what they talked about mile after mile in their rocking coach, or in the evenings as they dined together, what questions were asked, what observations made on life, politics, the law, the books they loved, their families, the future of their country. It was the closest time they ever spent in each other's company, and neither recorded a word about the other. But then neither wrote very much about anything, as if they had both declared a holiday from pen work, in Jefferson's expression. Birmingham, where they stopped at the Swan Inn, was the most distant point of the excursion. And the famous nearby farm known as Leeso's, once the home of the poet William Shenstone, was for Jefferson the most anticipated stop of the entire journey. Jefferson had long admired Shenstone's pastoral verse, but of greater importance had been the influence of Shenstone's own highly romantic description of Leeso's on Jefferson's plans for Monticello. Leeso's, one of the earliest of all the new style gardens, was considerably smaller than the others, set in gentle farmland, with a view of low hills to the south and west. But Leeso's had fallen into neglect since the poet's death, and Jefferson was greatly saddened and disappointed. It was nothing like what he had imagined. "This is not even an ornamental farm," he wrote. "It is only a grazing farm with a path around it, here and there a seat of a board, rarely anything better. Architecture has contributed nothing." Let Leeso's be an object lesson, he concluded. Shenstone had ruined himself financially with all he had spent on the farm, and so died of the heartaches which debt occasioned him. It was a lesson that Jefferson, alas, would not heed. To Adams, on the other hand, Leeso's was preferable to anything they had seen. The small scale of the place was more to a New Englander's liking. It was the simplest and plainest, the most rural of all, and thus particularly appealing, Adams thought. "I saw no spot so small that exhibited such a variety of beauties." From Leeso's, the travelers turned and headed south again, in the direction of London, stopping in the course of the next few days at Hagley Hall, a Palladian great house on a hill with a sweeping view somewhat like that of Monticello, Blenheim Palace at Woodstock, and then nearby Oxford, where they visited the university's botanical garden beside the River Charwell. By nightfall, April 9th, they were back in London. According to Adams's count, they had toured 20 country places in all, and he thought them high entertainment. Later, after a visit with Abigail to Payne's Hill on the outskirts of London at Surrey, where an immense ornamental park with lakes, grottos, hermit's hut, even a facsimile tent of an Arab prince had been created from a heap of sand, Adams declared it the most striking piece of art of any. Yet he hoped it would be a long time before such gardens ever became the fashion at home, where nature had done greater things on a nobler scale. How anyone could improve on Penn's Hill, Adams could not imagine. In London, Jefferson resumed his shopping spree, buying, among other things, another microscope and a pair of satin Florentine breeches. With the three Adamses and Colonel Smith, he toured the British Museum and, at Adams's urging, sat for Mather Brown. Commissioned by Adams, it was Jefferson's first portrait, and quite unlike anything done of him thereafter. A bust by Udon, for example, sculpted in Paris a few years later, would be Jefferson in the heroic mode, chin lifted, eyes on a distant horizon, Jefferson as frontiersman. In this, by Brown, he might have been the perfect European dandy, magnificent in ruffled shirt, hair dressed and powdered. He had a wistful, almost mournful expression, and there were dark circles under his eyes. It was Jefferson as courtier and romantic, and while some who saw it thought it a poor likeness, the Adamses appear to have been quite pleased. As requested, Brown would do a copy of the Jefferson portrait for them, as well as a copy of the Adams portrait for Jefferson. The original painting of Jefferson would ultimately disappear. The copy, which was hung prominently in the house on Grosvenor Square, would remain a proud possession in the Adams family for generations. On April 26th, he and Adams, having accomplished nothing in the way of diplomatic progress, and with no reason to expect a change in their prospects, Jefferson said his goodbyes and departed for Paris. Officially, his mission had been fruitless. But of Adams, Jefferson had more to say, writing from Paris to his friend Madison, as he had before on the subject. The difference this time was that Jefferson seemed to go out of his way, almost apologetically, to explain how Adams, with all his faults, had won his heart. "You know the opinion I formerly entertained of my friend Mr. Adams. Yourself and the governor were the first who shook that opinion. I afterwards saw proofs which convicted him of a degree of vanity and of blindness to it, of which no germ had appeared in Congress. A 7 months' intimacy with him here, and as many weeks in London, have given me opportunities of studying him closely. He is vain, irritable, and a bad calculator of the force and probable effect of the motives which govern men. This is all the ill which can be said of him. He is as disinterested as the being which made him. He is profound in his views and accurate in his judgment, except where knowledge of the world is necessary to form a judgment. He is so amiable that I pronounce you will love him if ever you become acquainted with him." Section 3. From the time of his arrival in their lives the previous year, Colonel William Smith had impressed John and Abigail as entirely deserving of his reputation as an admirable young man of great promise. He possesses a high sense of honor and as independent a spirit as any man I ever knew, and we have every reason to believe that his character will bear the strictest scrutiny. Abigail had written earlier to Cotton Tufts. "His character is not only fair and unblemished," she informed John Quincy, "but at age 21 he commanded a regiment, and through the whole war conducted with prudence and bravery and intrepidity when armed against the foe." She wished John Quincy to know this because Colonel Smith was like to become your brother. William Smith's interest in Nabby and hers in him had been apparent for months. But only after Nabby had formally broken her engagement to Royal Tyler would Abigail permit any mention of the new connection. The contrast between the character of Smith and Tyler was clear enough, she stressed to John Quincy, in an effort to explain his sister's decision. Besides, had not Shakespeare observed that a heart agitated with the remains of a former passion is most susceptible to a new one? Having concluded from day-to-day observation that his young secretary possessed all the qualifications necessary to make a faithful and agreeable companion for Nabby, John Adams left it to her to determine her own future. But Abigail spent hours with Nabby in close conversation. I begged her to satisfy herself that she had no prepossession left in her mind and heart, and she answered me, she never could be more determined. Abigail, however, as she confided to her sister Mary, had begun to find life increasingly empty and pointless. Her health was uneven. She was bothered by recurring rheumatism and severe headaches. She was tired of London and longed for home. When Mary apologized for filling her letters with too many Braintree particulars, Abigail replied, "Everything, however trivial, on that side of water interests me. Nothing here." "Can there be any pleasure in mixing company where you care for no one and nobody cares for you?" She dwelled increasingly on the fate of their brother William, whose drinking and errant ways had been a secret worry for years, and who by now, after abandoning his wife and children, had more or less disappeared. In correspondence among themselves, the three sisters never referred to William by name, only as "this unhappy connection," "the poor man," or "our dearest relative." Who was looking after him, Abigail wondered. What had been different about his childhood in the Weymouth parsonage? What might be in store for her own children? "I cannot, however, upon a retrospect of his education, refrain from thinking that some very capital mistakes were very indesignedly made," she would tell Mary. I say this to you who will not consider it as any reflection upon the memory of our dear parents, but only as a proof how much of the best and worthiest may err, and as some mitigation for the conduct of our deceased relatives. In the final days of May 1786, John Adams was called on to hurry to Amsterdam once again to secure still another desperately needed Dutch loan for the United States. On June 12th, Adams having returned, Nabby and Colonel William Smith were married in the house on Grosvenor Square, in a small ceremony with only a few friends present, the Copleys among others. In another few weeks, bride and groom moved to a new address on Wimpole Street. "The young couple appear to be very happy," was all that Adams had to say in a letter to James Warren. While to Mary Cranch, Abigail described the ceremony as too solemn and important an event for her not to have experienced an agitation equal to what she had felt at her own wedding. The night before the wedding, she further confided, she had dreamed of Royal Tyler, and strangely found herself feeling sorry for him. Abigail and Nabby had been faithful companions for years, through all of John's endless absences. They had been virtually inseparable, and the change now was difficult for Abigail. She had made the young couple promise to dine at Grosvenor Square every day. Still, she was as lonesome as she had ever been. To boost her spirits, she imagined a marriage between John Quincy and Patsy Jefferson, and to Jefferson playfully proposed the idea. While it was true, she wrote, that in losing her daughter she had gained a son, she already had three sons. What she needed was another daughter. "Suppose you give me Miss Jefferson, and in some future day take a son in lieu of her. I am for strengthening the Federal Union." At home in Massachusetts, meantime, John Quincy had been denied admission to Harvard, until he completed several months of tutoring in Greek with the Reverend Shaw at Haverhill. But then in March 1786, John Quincy, too, had become a son of Harvard. "He must not study too hard," Adams cautioned kindly. "The smell of the midnight lamp is very unwholesome. Never defraud yourself of sleep nor your walk. You need not now be in a hurry." What was essential, Adams advised, was an inquisitive mind. John Quincy must get to know the most exceptional scholars and question them closely. "Ask them about their tutors, manner of teaching. Observe what books lie on their tables. Ask them about the late war, or fall into questions of literature, science, or what you will." The more Adams thought about the future of his country, the more convinced he became that it rested on education. "Before any great things are accomplished," he wrote to a correspondent, "a memorable change must be made in the system of education, and knowledge must become so general as to raise the lower ranks of society nearer to the higher. The education of a nation, instead of being confined to a few schools and universities for the instruction of the few, must become the national care and expense for the formation of the many." That his own exceptional eldest son, with the advantages he had, could one day play a part in bringing about such a memorable change, he had every confidence. When Elizabeth Shaw wrote that, as agreeable as John Quincy might be in company, he could be in private conversation a little too decisive and tenacious in his opinions, Abigail responded with a strong letter of motherly advice to the young man. Watchfulness over yourself was called for, lest his knowledge make him arrogant. If you are conscious to yourself that you possess more knowledge upon some subjects than others of your standing, reflect that you have had greater opportunities of seeing the world and obtaining a knowledge of mankind than any of your contemporaries, that you have never wanted a book but it has been supplied to you, that your whole time has been spent in the company of men of literature and science. how unpardonable would it have been in you to have been a blockhead? By now, Charles, too, had entered Harvard at age 15. More outgoing than his older brother, Charles was thought to be too easily distracted from his studies. Where John Quincy required a warning against the perils of the midnight lamp, Charles needed reminding that such a lamp existed. Remembering so much that went on in his own days at Harvard other than classwork and studies, Adams wrote affectionately to his second son, "You have in your nature a sociability, Charles, which is amiable but may mislead you. A scholar is always made alone. Studies can only be pursued to good purpose by yourself. Don't let your companions, then, nor your amusements, take up too much of your time." Adams was himself spending increasing amounts of time alone, working intently and seldom to good purpose, he felt. The impasse over the withdrawal of British troops from the American Northwest and the payment of American debts to British creditors continued. Lord Carmarthen readily agreed that by the Paris Treaty, His Majesty's armed forces were to depart from the United States with all convenient speed. But, as he liked also to point out, the same treaty stipulated that creditors on either side shall meet with no lawful impediment to the recovery of the full value in sterling of all bona fide debts. "I flatter myself, however, sir," Carmarthen told